The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. It's the programme where we bring you different Christians in all walks of faith and life, talking about their faith journey. And today I'm joined by Lucy Pepiat, who's Principal of Westminster Theological Centre. I'll be introducing Lucy in a moment's time, but if you'd like to hear more editions of The Profile via our podcast, why not go online at premierchristianradio.com/theprofile, or indeed just look it up wherever you get your podcasts from. And while you're there, why not get hold of the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine? The Profile is brought to you in association with that title, and there you can read more interesting interviews with all kinds of people in Christian leadership in different areas of life. If you want a free sample copy of Premier Christianity magazine, go to the website premierchristianity.com/free sample. Lucy, welcome along to The Profile.
Thanks, Justin.
It's great to have you with me.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to digging into your past, into your journey, and also into a recent book you've written called Unveiling Paul's Women, Making Sense of 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16. We'll come to that a bit later on in the programme. But you are principal at Westminster Theological Centre in Bristol. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's actually, I live in Bristol and our offices are in Cheltenham. But it was the first college in this country to set up a new system of delivery through a mixture of residentials and local hubs. Mm. So it's a sort of mixed mode of delivery. We offer part-time theological degrees and that's all that we do.
I noticed from the website you have these hubs now pretty much all over the UK.
Nearly all over the UK. We're still looking at a few areas where we'd love to set up some hubs. But our aim is to make affordable, accessible theological education through the local church and actually literally in the local church. Mm. So it just give access to normal people who are not necessarily wanting to get ordained or to be, you know, to go into formal ministry, but just want to learn more about their faith and be educated in their faith and in a context that's very vibrant, very dynamic, very spirit-filled. So it's great fun.
Has the college had a sort of background in a particular denomination or anything like that? Does it welcome people from across the spectrum?
Yes. So my predecessor, when he set it up, had Anglican roots. Mm-hmm. But then when we made some changes in 2012, and it's now interdenominational. So it's interesting seeing the demographic of our students has really shifted in the last 6 years. And we have people from all over, which is brilliant.
Yeah, that's really encouraging. If you want to find out more about Westminster Theological Centre, it's wtctheology.org.uk. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Lucy. Is being a Christian something you always have thought of yourself as, or was there a moment when something happened? What's the story behind your becoming a Christian?
Well, I was brought up in a brilliant home. My parents are both Christians, both Anglicans. Well, my mother wouldn't say she's an Anglican. She was a Presbyterian. But she married an Anglican, went to an Anglican church. My dad was. And actually, I think of it as a very gentle form of Christianity that I was brought up in. Mm. They weren't evangelicals. I didn't mix in evangelical circles. And they were very freeing, brilliant parents, really, and just sort of let us do what we want and talk and chat and debate about anything. So my own journey was that I wasn't really very committed. I think I believed that God existed. I'm not sure I never didn't think that, but I didn't live as a Christian. Then certainly went to university, certainly didn't. But then after university in the following years, found myself mixing actually with some really wonderful Christians, partly through my cousin's family, and it became something that became more and more and more attractive to me. So whereas at university I had been irritated by evangelical Christians and just didn't really want much to do with them, despite them trying to convert me, it was later on when I was working with the homeless in London, in fact just around the corner from Premier Christianity at the Passage. So working with a bunch of Catholics who I found fascinating, they were all pretty intelligent, and that mattered to me, that that people had thought deeply about their faith and were well read. But they were committed to the poor, and that mattered to me as well. And then I met some similar types of people in the sort of evangelical charismatic world. And rather than hounding me, they kind of wooed me into the into the center. And I toppled in and gave my life to Jesus properly,
right,
and was filled with the Spirit. Wow. And ever since then, I was nearly 24, and I'm a committed charismatic. That was the thing that won me in the end, was the life of the Spirit, which I thought was way more fun and interesting than anything anything else.
People sometimes, unfortunately, they do sort of see the charismatic end of the church spectrum as somehow being anti-intellectual sometimes, anti-theological even. So obviously you've seen a way of bringing that together, not seeing any kind of conflict there.
Yeah, no, you're right. And actually, it is a bit of an unthinking wing of the church. I mean, let's be honest, you know, because it's based on experience and feeling, and, you know, people sort of saying, oh, this must be true because I felt it, or and things, you know, us all running around claiming that God's spoken to us. Well, those are pretty big claims, and how do we measure that, you know? But obviously in me was this academic, which I didn't really know I was going to be an academic, as much as I was brought up in quite a sort of academic-y type family. But it was, I actually, in my mid-20s, felt that God was calling me into a preaching ministry, which was sort of slightly strange because I had literally just become a committed Christian, ended up marrying a vicar, which was not in my life's plan. But felt quite clearly just after I got married that, that I should do a lay reader's training in the Diocese of London. This was back in the 90s. Which is a preaching role. And I was a young woman then, obviously, and there weren't many young women who did train to be lay readers, but you could do if you wanted. And my husband, who was my curate, and my uncle, who was my vicar, said, both said, oh, that's a great idea. So so I trundled off and did this training with a bunch of 60-year-old men and loved it. And that was my first brush with theology. So I'd done an English degree before.
And the lights came on.
I was completely hooked. I thought, this is fantastic. And so as soon as I could, after I'd had some children, I enrolled for a Bachelor of Divinity degree, which I did remotely from mainly from Africa, and got that. And then I never stopped. I went on.
And you've been preaching and teaching ever since, and of course moved into this role you have now with Westminster Theological Centre. I mean, at any point along the way, did you meet someone who said, you shouldn't be doing this, you're a woman?
Oh, well, that's an interesting... I had people worried about my faith.
Okay.
Which goes back to your previous question of, you know, should we as committed Christians go into theology because it might damage your faith?
Sure, yeah.
My experience was the opposite. No, I was very sheltered from this whole women thing. Because, well, I married my church leader, so and he thought like me, so that was fine. I it wasn't really until I became the principal of WTC and was moving then almost exclusively really in evangelical circles. So before that, we had my husband and I had a very interesting journey in our churches. We started in London, went to Zimbabwe, went to inner city Sheffield, and then started a Fresh Expressions. So we were sort of moving in our own circles in a funny way. But then I was immersed in this evangelical world. And of course, it was then that people said, oh, I know people who think you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. And not actually our students particularly. I think there's a self-selection that goes on if you have a female principal, right?
Yeah.
But Yeah, and one person, he was a new Christian, who was really shocked. He said, I've got a friend who says, I shouldn't study here because you're the principal.
Gosh, right.
And I thought, oh, right, perhaps I ought to have some good answers for this. So, whereas I had sort of been rather breezily going along thinking, well, I can do what I want, so it doesn't really affect me. And then then that became something I couldn't carry, was this reality that because I had been privileged, that I just didn't address it. And I thought, that's actually unacceptable. I had been highly educated. Bible Society paid for my PhD, which was wonderful. My husband was incredibly supportive, as were then my teenage boys and our church. And you know, so I had been put in this position where someone had educated me. And I thought, I can't just keep my mouth shut.
You need to make good on that, I suppose. We'll come to all of this in a bit more depth a bit later, because this is very much all tied in, obviously, to the theme of your latest book as well. But take us a little bit on that journey of the ministry that you've been involved in local churches. Sounds like you've had quite an exciting life going different places with your husband, Nick, and the ministry you've shared together in that way. Now, I think that expresses itself in local ministry in a church called CrossNet.
Yes.
Tell us about CrossNet and what's led you up to that point.
Well, we started quite conventionally. Nick got a job actually with my uncle. I didn't know him then. So he did his curacy with in East Twickenham with my uncle Martin Pepiot, and he did a 5-year curacy. We met and married in the middle of that. So there we were in Twickenham, which was lovely. The people were really lovely. But I think that both of us have a sort of slightly nomadic side to us, and we were up for some kind of adventure. So when Nick got a call saying, would you look at a job in Harare?
Wow.
We thought,
Zimbabwe.
Yes. Yeah. We thought, oh, well, we'll have a look. And it was the right place for us to go. It was really clear. So we went out there after Twickenham with a toddler and an 8-week-old baby, and arrived. We'd actually gone to visit, and so we'd met some people before, and we were really looking forward to going. It was the most wonderful 6 years. We planned to go for probably about 3, and we stayed for 6.
What was, I mean, 6 years obviously is hard to sum up in a few sentences, but obviously, many people are aware of all of the ongoing change in that country because of Mugabe and everything. I don't know what period exactly you were there, but what did you see and sense in terms of the feel of the place, and what were you doing to some extent in terms of your local ministry there?
Yeah, so Nick was the rector of a large Anglican church in the middle of Harare. And it was one of the evangelical churches. Zimbabwe mainly had been sort of populated by the high Anglican church, and that had affected the Anglican church across the board in the country. But there were pockets of evangelicalism, and this was one of them. And it was the most wonderful church. We absolutely loved everyone to bits. They were our family. It was multiracial. It was multicultural. And what struck us really from day one was just how loving, how kind people are in Zimbabwe. I think the reason that Mugabe stayed on for so long is that actually the Zimbabweans are pretty peaceable. Yeah. You know, they're wonderful people. In another country, you'd have had a lot of violence. They're very prayerful. So we were there 93 to 99. So this was before the real troubles kicked off.
Sure.
But we wouldn't have got a permit to stay much beyond actually. Yeah. And so in some senses, they were the golden years, I guess, although we saw the writing on the wall of trouble coming. Yeah. We had friends who were deeply affected by it. And so it's close to our heart, but it is an amazing country. Mm-hmm. We pray for it still, and we're going, you know, we'll go out and visit again at some point.
Yes. And obviously that fantastic experience in that multicultural, beautiful setting that you were in, coming back to the UK, what did that give you in terms of the way you then approach ministry back here on British shores.
Yeah, we made a decision, which we felt God was calling us to move back to inner city Sheffield. And as you can tell from my accent, we're not Northerners. And we felt a strong call to by God to go to somewhere where they had next to nothing. And this church was an extraordinary church. It was tiny in terms of its congregation, but feisty, as Sheffielders are, and in the middle of an estate that was actually in upheaval, that there's been a lot of building work done. And the diocese, I think, wanted to just shut this church down and, you know, amalgamate it with something else, and the people resisted. And we came in at that point. They said, we want our own priest in charge. We believe that God has a plan for this church, and we believe that too. So we went from this vibrant, extraordinary, sunny, wonderful African church,
quite large as well,
it was
church,
hundreds, and five services a day, to a tiny grey Sheffield church. And
quite a contrast.
It was a huge contrast, and there were no children in the church when we went there. So we went there with our four little boys. There was one family with
one. So your boys became the children's church, basically.
They did, and they said, "Mum, where are the children?" And I said, "Well, we're going to pray that the children come."
Brilliant, I love
so
it.
So it was tough, actually. Yeah, it was a tough decision, but we never regretted it. And it was really good for us. It was really, really good as this Southern family to go and live for 5 years in Sheffield, and to get to know people and to love them and be loved by them. It was brilliant.
How did you leave the church after 5 years?
Well, it was really exciting because we did a building project, which was kind of not in the plan, but I had felt God speak to me prophetically and over the church when we arrived. Didn't really as exactly what it meant, but I felt God say that he was going to take the roof off the church, and I thought, oh, that sounds really exciting. And then 6 weeks later woke up and felt God say, I'm going to provide everything you need for the finances in the church. And I thought, well, that's exciting, because the annual income for the church was about £11,000. We then, a few days later, our warden turned up and said, she was in a real flap because she said the architect had been, and the church had nail sickness in the roof, and the entire roof had to come off and be replaced.
How interesting.
And it was going to cost £150,000, and we didn't have any money in our church. And so my husband, to her great annoyance, laughed and said, I'm sure it's going to be fine, Joyce, because God's spoken about it. Anyway, that kicked off an absolutely brilliant step of faith on their part to do a massive rebuilding. Wow. Thing which cost £500,000. So we left a brand spanking new building with no debt and a little thriving congregation. So the congregation had grown up to about 70 or 80. There were children running around. It was brilliant. All brilliant. Yeah,
that's just so good to hear about what happens when you sort of go somewhere which looks so different, but where you think actually God's calling us and something happens. I mean, fascinating to hear about the sort of that prophetic moment as well. I mean, as someone who obviously is comfortable in that sort of stream of the church, the charismatic church, have you had any other moments where you can say something happened, you know, there was God definitely did something in a supernatural way, or you had an experience which you know has remained with you for some time in terms of the prophetic ministry or anything of that? Because I think sometimes people just think of theologians as just being interested in doctrine and
books.
You know, books, making sure we all, you know, have the right sort of thoughts about things. But I think it's really interesting to hear someone who's obviously interested in that, but also believes God is speaking in very direct ways sometimes, and in ways that kind of, you know,
shape you and change
absolutely.
Things. And
Are there any kind of moments you can point to as being significant in your journey on that front?
Really, honestly, I would say hundreds.
Right.
Hundreds
so
and
hard
hundreds.
To choose between.
But the one, a big formative moment for me was when I was working at WTC. I was teaching a module And things got very, very difficult because my predecessor, for good reasons, resigned very suddenly. Mm. And we didn't see it coming. I don't think he saw it coming, to be honest. Mm. But, you know, these things happen. Mm. And so it threw the organization into turmoil. And I knew that it was in turmoil. And I knew that that it was actually kind of really life-threatening, potentially, for the college, because it did all rest on him. Mm. And so I prayed, and I knelt down and I said, Lord, what should I do? And I felt God say to me, phone the chairman and offer to help. And I had met the chairman at a New Wine the year before, and I was good friends with the director of operations. So I phoned my friend and I said, could you give me his number? And I got his number and I phoned him and I offered to help. And that was the beginning of an extraordinary journey, which then led me to where I am today. Mm. But what happened was that I, at crucial moments of where I had to make a decision or someone was about to come to me to ask me to make a decision, I felt God speaking to me about that before it happened. Right. So very little took me by surprise. Mm. And I felt very deep down prepared for things that were about to happen in a way that I've never felt in my life before. Right. And I think that it was just because God wanted me to do what I'm doing now for the time that I do it, and one day I'll step down and hand over to someone else. But I think that I'll know when I'm supposed to do that.
And I suppose that ability or sense that God is speaking and there ahead of the things that happen is only possible if you are sort of in some sort of committed prayer relationship with God, where you're asking God to speak in that sense. And I think very often, again, there can be this disjunct between the theologian who sort of knows God through scripture and thinking and everything, and actually that very simple experience of praying and asking God to be present in our day. And I suppose as someone who obviously leads a theological college, you need to be on your knees as much as, you know,
I think
leading from the front, in a sense.
I think also some of it is about language, because I know a lot of wonderful theologians who perhaps wouldn't be as sort of blatant as I would be about saying, well, I think God said this, you know, but actually are so spirit-led and God-led. And I know they pray, and I know they pray for their students. And you can read it in their books that God is communicating with them. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But it's not, they wouldn't perhaps frame it in charismatic ways. But but you're right, the hearing from God is rooted in a relationship and an expectation that he will speak in some way. But I think it's the best thing about the Christian life, really.
Absolutely. You've already mentioned you've got four boys.
Yeah.
So did God tell you ahead of time that you'd be having
thankfully.
Four boys? You'd never have gone down that route otherwise.
There are some things he doesn't say for good reasons. I had my family one child at a time, which was important. I didn't plan to have... We didn't plan to have four, I should say. We literally did one at a time. I think that was how we approached it. We thought, well, we've got one. We think we'd like to have another.
Yes.
I had a miscarriage. I think loads of women have miscarriages and some have a lot. And, you know, so it's unpredictable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Having babies.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
But no, we're hugely blessed. And I love my sons to bits. And I think having four boys as a mother is just one of the best things ever.
I think I saw some of them when you were at Spring Harvest recently accompanying you. And they all tower. They all seem like strapping lads. And, you know, I guess having four boys in the house, I mean, makes for a slightly chaotic, I don't know. Kind of,
irreverent, I would say.
Kind of atmosphere.
Yes.
It
does. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of fun, quite a lot of bawdy humour.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. And they are actually all Christians and they haven't always been. And we wanted to create an environment where they could ask anything and be anything, actually, because that was the way I was brought up. And I thought that was a better way to be brought up, even though you run the risk of your kids going off the rails. But if you try and hold on to them too tightly, they will, you know, they could as well. So we just sort of let them do stuff, and they did. Mm. And we talked a lot, and we prayed for them a lot. Yeah. And they are all Christians now, yeah. Which is great.
Which is amazing. And in a sense, there's no guarantees of that sort of thing in life, is there? And we all have to ultimately put it in the hands of God.
Exactly.
But it's great to know that they've obviously had a good example, in a sense. And even though I guess some people worry, especially I think people in ministry, whether their children will necessarily see the best of what Christianity has to offer, because they inevitably see the background
they
stuff.
Do see,
don't they
see some pretty awful stuff. Yeah. And actually, I think being honest about that is one of the things that helps them. Well, as long as you don't, it doesn't completely crush you. I think that is crushing for a child to see their parent, you know, really, really mashed up.
Yeah.
But if one does manage to go through those dreadful times and surface, then they also see that. And the other thing that we did a lot of was debate. And I do think that young Christians are more intelligent than people perhaps give them credit for. Mm. And we must remember that in most schools, their faith is being undermined consistently and regularly.
Right.
And so I know you have an interest in apologetics. Mm. Well, our teenage boys, that was the thing I think that saved them.
Right, that's interesting.
Right, so apologetics is so good for certain people at certain times, and it can really, really plug a gap that other things can't.
Well, we're talking today on The Profile to Lucy Pepiat. She's my guest, Principal of Westminster Theological Centre. I'm Justin Brierley, and The Profile brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you want a free sample of the latest edition of the mag, do go online, premierchristianity.com/freesample. And I'll be continuing my conversation with Lucy on the other half of a short break.
Premier Christianity magazine. In this month's issue,
find out how the church reacted to the Grenfell Tower fire in our exclusive interview with Bishop Graham Tomlin. Plus, is hidden disappointment killing the church? We look at how to handle this difficult emotion and discover Christian views on gender and women's ministry in the church. Plus 5 miraculous stories, news, reviews and more. Out now in the June edition.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second half of today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, and The Profile is the programme every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, where we bring you a really interesting Christian in some walk of life. And today it's a church leader and theologian that I'm speaking to, Lucy Pepiat. If you want to listen to more episodes of The Profile, we're available as a podcast. Find us at premierchristianradio.com/theprofile or wherever you get your podcasts from. And don't forget that The Profile brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. And if you'd like a free sample copy of the latest edition of the mag, go to our website and ask for one, premierchristianity.com/freesample. It's been really lovely talking to you about your family life and your ministry up till now, Lucy, and all that you've been doing with Westminster Theological Centre. You've written a book recently.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Unveiling Paul's Women, Making Sense of 1 Corinthians 11, 2 to 16. Now, you're not the first person to try and make sense of these passages.
No.
But before we get into that, let me read out 1 Corinthians to 11, 1 to 16, which in the NIV begins with the title Uncovering the Head in Worship.
Oh.
It says here, I praise you for remembering me in everything and for holding to the traditions just as I pass them on to you. But I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is the same as having her head shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, she might as well have her hair cut off. But if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. It is for this reason that a woman ought to have authority over her own head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman. But everything comes from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him, but that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory? For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about that, this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. So this is, I think, often left people scratching their heads, this bit of Paul's letter,
yeah,
which in so many other places is full of really helpful stuff that, mm-hmm, you know,
yeah,
1
yeah.
Corinthians 13, you know.
Exactly.
No wedding is complete without, you know, yeah, Paul's words on love and that sort of thing. But this particular passage, and perhaps maybe related a passage later in 1 Corinthians 14, I think people, not only are they struggling to understand what exactly Paul is saying, mm, but a lot of what people think he's saying, we find in our churches today in all kinds of different ways as somehow manifest in the idea, for instance, that if a woman is to have any position of leadership, she needs to have so-called covering of a man, the covering, yep, of a sort of some sort of male authority. And you might see that, for instance, in evangelical circles where you might have a husband and wife team leading, yep, a church, but it's somehow seen that the woman is only, yeah, that's only valid if there's a man, as it were, providing the so-called covering. So there's lots of directions we can go in,
yeah,
with this. You've written a book attempting to give your explanation of what's going,
yes,
on here. Did you succeed? Do you feel like you've got to the bottom of 1 Corinthians 11?
I think I've given a good explanation. I'm not the only person to go down the route that I went down. Mm. So what I did, and actually I wrote a book before Unveiling Paul's Women called Women and Worship at Corinth, which is a more academic book. It's a more academic presentation, mm, of
this
my...
This is more the lay-level version
it
of
is
that stuff.
Because,
yeah,
I wrote Women in Worship, and I also teach, obviously, at my own college, and I teach around the country and things. And I was being asked by a lot of people, could you just condense your argument just over this head coverings issue and say what you think? So I eventually got around to doing it, and it was much harder than I thought. But I'm quite pleased with Unveiling Paul's Women. I enjoyed writing it in the end, and I think that it is quite clear and accessible to pretty much anyone. I don't think you have to have a very high level of understanding, pre-understanding.
Okay. So what's going on? I mean,
right,
where do you want to start in this passage?
I love it for some reason. I've read it 4 billion times.
I thought you'd
times.
Be sick of it by now,
no,
having looked at it in such
no,
depth. But no,
you still
like reading it. Okay,
I'm so fascinated by it. I love reading it, and I've studied it for years and years. I began with this passage because people asked me, what do you think about women in leadership? And I thought, well, I think it's fine for women to be in leadership. But I hadn't really wrestled with all of the debates, yeah, and the discussions, etc. So I went to this one first. And I'm glad I did, because it's endlessly fascinating. Mm. And I began to read all of the different explanations for what Paul was trying to get at when he was saying women should wear head coverings and men shouldn't. So that's this kind of basic premise of the passage,
yeah,
although you'll have noticed that we end up with hair in the second half,
yes,
right? So there is a debate about whether Paul's talking about hairstyles or head coverings.
Okay.
Most scholars will go on to the head covering side. That's where I am. I think in the first half, up until verse 10, he's talking about head coverings, and his instruction is men shouldn't wear them and women should.
Right.
And when you get to 16, he says, and we have no such custom in any other of our churches. That's what he says. So
okay,
so you need to make a decision, because no one's
okay
doing anything else.
Right.
And so I'm actually enforcing this practice on you of the women should wear head coverings, men shouldn't.
Okay.
So that's what's in the text,
yes,
for us.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some other very troubling, puzzling, difficult bits of the passage. The first is, why is he saying that women should wear head coverings when they pray and prophesy? Why is he saying that men shouldn't? And a lot of people, to try and make this more palatable for us, say, well, it was cultural. Mm-hmm. You know, women wore head coverings mm-hmm. back then, didn't they? So mm-hmm. that's fine. Right. So that explains it.
Yeah.
But actually, that doesn't explain it because women didn't all wear head coverings back then. There were different practices okay. depending on whether you were a Greek, a Roman, or a Jew. And obviously, the men the same. It depended on whether you were Greek or Roman or Jew, whether you put a shawl over your head when you prayed. Mm. So the idea that Paul would say to a Jewish man, take your head covering off, is odd.
Yes.
And he was Jewish. Mm. So first of all, we got a few questions about, well, why? There's not an obvious answer. And you can't go down the cultural route because the culture of the time doesn't allow you to do that. But secondly, you can't because actually the reason that Paul gives you in the passage is not cultural, it's creation. And so he does give his own reasons in verse 8. Mm-hmm. Well, starting in 7.
Yes. Yeah, do you want to read that out?
Yes. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. So there is something inherent in a man, which in his relationship to God, which means that he doesn't need to wear a head covering. And there's something inherent in woman in her relationship to man, which means that she should wear one. Mm. Now, that's quite a serious claim, actually. So that really got my attention.
Yeah.
So verses 7 to 9, I found deeply troubling. Mm. And as you said, I'm a theologian. And so I have studied quite a lot about the image of God, theology, and the implications of that. Mm. And this strikes me as being not in line with what we study in Genesis.
Right.
So that should cause us to ask questions. For man did not... Well, it kind of could be, right? For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Oh, we're familiar with that.
Right.
Because that's Genesis 2.
Yes, sure.
So that's okay. Mm-hmm. So we're all right. But neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. Well, yeah, that sounds familiar too. Mm. And we're okay with that. Mm-hmm. But then that's the reason given for why women should wear head coverings in church. For this reason, and because of the angels. Well, that's even more puzzling.
It's kind of like he chucks in the angels.
What are they doing?
Where do they come
from? Exactly. and what are they thinking? And why do they need women to have... Because it's for these reasons that a woman ought to have a sign of authority on her. And so even more layers and layers of this, the reasons given for why a woman should wear a head covering in church when she prays and prophesies.
Some footnotes from Paul would have been really helpful.
It would have been. So, and then he says, you should all do it and we don't have any other custom. You jump to 16. But in the middle bit, he seems to be actually backtracking.
Yes.
Yeah. So everyone notices that, but they don't really know what to do with it. And so you come to verse 11. Oh, in the Lord, however, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, then this is his prepositions that he uses, picks up from 7 to 9. In the same way, you know, woman did come from man, we think, in Genesis 2. That's a kind of Christian theology. But then he adds this, so also man is born out of woman, through woman.
So it's almost like he sort of says, hang on a minute, but men are also born of women.
Exactly.
It's almost as though there's a little bit of a...
What's he doing? Slightly. Is he trying to balance it? Is he going back? Is he backtracking? Is he changing his mind? People are divided on that. Okay. They don't really know. And then he asks this question, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Let me go back to the beginning. So I'll tell you what I think, and then I'll tell you why I think these questions are important that he comes to in 13 and 14. Because when I read the passage, a year before I had been to a conference with a scholar called Douglas Campbell, who has written quite a controversial thesis on Romans, actually. And he argues that there are places in Romans where Paul is quoting a Judaizing opponent, and that it's not actually Paul's words, that it's in Paul's letter and he wrote it, but he's using somebody else's argument to build his own.
Okay, right? So it's like he's sort of saying, now this person says this,
yes,
but here's but my I response say this, kind yes. of thing. Okay.
And I heard him speak on this, and I was really interested in his argument, and I found the conference interesting. But what it sparked off for me was the I realized, of course, this Paul is doing this in different places. And actually, in 1 Corinthians, we know he's doing it because he's responding to the Corinthian letter. 1 Corinthians is actually 2 Corinthians. It's his second letter
right.
to the Corinthians.
Though we don't have the first
we
one.
We don't have the
yeah,
first
so we call this
so
one.
So he's yeah. responding to something they've written to yeah. him. He's in a dialogue with them. And the frustrating thing for us is we only get half the conversation.
Yes. Yeah.
So I looked at this, and as I studied it over and over and over again, and as I read everybody's explanations that I could possibly try and read, all of which I actually found really unsatisfactory. So I was reading these explanations. I thought, gosh, they're very convoluted and they're really difficult. So you've got some people who traditionally, people mostly read this passage to say that Paul thought that women were subordinate to men. So that was, and they didn't, but they didn't really have a problem with that. It's only in recent history that people are more embarrassed by that. So then they try and twist it round to try and say, well, Paul kind of thought that, but not really, because then he goes back on himself. And anyway, lots of different explanations. But as I read it, I thought, well, I wonder if, what if he's in conversation with the Corinthians who are making women wear head coverings in his absence? So he set up the church and he was there for 18 months and then he left. And in his absence, the church is obviously being run by actually a group of leaders who are divided among themselves, as we know from the beginning of the letter. We also know that there is a problem with the men in Corinth and that they are domineering and dominating and that he is rebuking them and disciplining them in this letter. So and there are textual clues to that. So I think there is good evidence that there are a bunch of men in Corinth who were very concerned about their honour and their status. Again, this is scholarship about Corinth. And that somehow they've taken Paul's teaching on the head teaching that is Paul's, that man is the kephale of woman, and they've made it into a reason for women to have to wear head coverings
right.
in the church. Okay. But actually, it's an oppressive practice, because what they're saying is that unless you have a sign that's kind of going to compensate for your lack of glory, that's because man is the image and glory of God, but you're the glory of man. So unless you have something that's going to put the angels' minds to rest and put the cosmic, you know, keep the order in the cosmos, you can't speak. You mustn't say anything. And the idea for that a Christian woman should have something on her head in terms of a physical sort of scarf or veil in order to do something before God is a very odd concept.
One, though, that has in a sense been seen in churches down the ages, in as much as, you know, even within our lifetime, that there has been a tradition of women wearing a hat in church, or something that might be seen as a sort of, you know, something that came from this tradition.
It could have come from this. It could also have been a sign of respect.
Right.
So it could be either, right. I think. Yeah. I mean, and it could have come from the fact that Christian faith was born in a Middle Eastern culture where women did
wear, that was culturally something were, that, exactly. that would have been
so,
expected.
And I've been to...
But the question is, was it commanded, obviously?
Exactly. That's the question.
And that's where what you're obviously addressing here. And what you seem to have done is said, hang on a minute, this passage is Paul's commentary on what other people are saying in the Church of Corinth, particularly these men.
Yes.
There's this debate going on.
Yes.
And so is there a sense in which you would sort of highlight certain sentences within this passage and say, this is where he's quoting what they're saying?
Yes, I would say that. And I would probably steer away a little bit from direct quotation idea. But I think I would say more that he is expressing their ideas through his words.
Okay.
So would you put it in quotation marks? You could do. And there are quotation marks. It's a fascinating letter, 1 Corinthians, because editors go through. There are no quotation marks in the original Greek.
Right.
But when you read your version in your Bible, you will see that at points editors have put in quotation marks. So the beginning of chapter 6 is one, and in chapter 8 there's another, where they put quotes round certain of Paul's phrases, because they say, oh, he's quoting the Corinthians.
Right.
And so and some of that is still under discussion, like in chapter 8. But so here, yes, I think that you start to encounter Corinthian thought in verse 4.
So from instance, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head.
Yes.
He's sort of saying, here's what you've been saying.
Yes. And I think they would have, well, if they had said it, they'd know.
Right.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So this is my theory. You said, have I come up with an answer? I think I've come up with a good answer.
Okay.
And I think if you look at it and you study it, so what I did in Women and Worship was that I deliberately tried to find the problems in current explanations, and I wanted people to really think. If you want to think this, you need to know what the problems with your explanation are. And I think that I've been quite honest about what I think the problems with my explanation are. One is that there's no proof. I mean, that's what people say to me. Well, how do you know? Because there's no quotation marks. And I say, I know, but so how do you know? Because there's no quotation marks. So,
in a sense, we're having to work with what we've got and come up with the best explanation.
Exactly.
And for you, the balance of evidence seems to lie in the direction of saying he's engaging an argument that they've been putting forward.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it, actually, because I think that for me, the balance of evidence in the whole of his letters, not just in this passage, although I love this passage because it's so complicated and you have to, and it taxes your brain in such an amazing way, because you get to verse 11 and then you think, well, what are you doing now? And then he says, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? And I think, well, yes, we do that all the time. So did you, Paul, really think? I think by that stage he was getting to the Corinthians and going, oh, come on, guys. Look, because he starts with prayer and prophecy, ends up with prayer.
I mean, the way you put it near the conclusion of the book is like this. You say, my conclusion is that I think Paul is saying the exact opposite of what most people think he says. Mm. And if we accept this reading, it turns the situation on its head. So just to start to bring this together, You actually think that Paul's taking something that they're saying, there should be this system where women have their heads covered and men don't need to, and they've sort of extrapolated something erroneous from what Paul's has been teaching about headship.
Yes.
And Paul's coming back and saying, this is what you're saying, actually. Mm. So where does he kind of actually... Because I think most people might struggle to see exactly what he does come out as saying then, if you're saying that.
Yes.
So what's his actual advice on the situation?
So I think that what he does, my favourite verse probably is verse 14, because he asks them a question, which he's going to answer. I mean, it's a rhetorical question. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? So it really is an open-ended question. And then he says, does not the very nature of things, he's speaking to men here, does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace to him? Now, that's a very peculiar thing for Paul to say, because when he went to Corinth, he took a vow not to cut his hair. And probably a Nazarite vow. And so he'd been growing his hair in Corinth for 18 months. Now, I don't know if you've seen anyone who's been growing their hair with not having cut for 18 months.
It starts to become
it's longer than mine.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And very funnily, I had a godson who came to visit, a wonderful Australian godson who came to visit with us. And he had this wonderful, long, luscious hair. And I said, oh, how long have you been growing that for? And he said, 18 months. And I was like, can I take a photo of you?
Yeah. The evidence
like,
of what happens to
brilliant.
Hair after 18 months. Yes.
It was long, long
right.
hair.
Yeah.
And so Paul had long hair. So what's he doing here? saying, does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace to him? Mm. You see, I think that the Corinthians had strict rules about head coverings and hairstyles, and Paul actually broke their rules.
I see.
And I think that they thought his long hair was disgraceful, so he is kind of tweaking their tails a bit here and teasing them and saying, come on chaps, you yourselves think that long hair on a man's a disgrace, but then, you know, give credit, but that if a woman has long hair, it's her glory. That's what you think.
Yeah.
So where is, what does she need on top of the fact that she's a woman created in the image of God and she has hair, which is her glory? She doesn't need anything else. Stop making her wear a head covering.
Which, as you say, is almost the exact opposite of what a lot of people have thought Paul was saying here. Mm. And it's kind of down to the fact that we don't have the other half of the conversation.
Yes.
And that it's sometimes difficult for us from the original Greek to know when Paul's engaging with their arguments and when he's actually speaking. So we're sort of having to do a fair amount of the legwork ourselves in that.
Exactly.
But it makes a huge difference as to what we end up doing in our churches,
it's
obviously.
It's an opposite difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, one question that might emerge from this is, and I interact with a lot of skeptics who, you know, have problems with Christianity because they think it's sexist or whatever. And they might say, couldn't God just have made it clearer?
Yes.
What do you say to that?
Oh, my gosh. I'm totally with them. I mean, yeah, I think that often. And I look back over 2,000 years of history and... is Christianity sexist? The truth is that Christianity has been expressed in through sexist and patriarchal structures and forms really pretty much for 2,000 years. But I think that we're at a very interesting time in history where there is a shift. I feel a shift. I sense a shift. It's a very interesting thing. One of the interesting things that's happened, obviously I'm a female scholar, but the level of education that is open now to women, first in general, is hugely higher than really it's ever been, I guess, globally, and certainly in the church, and certainly in the evangelical church, that there are way more women scholars now. Still not a lot, I have to tell you, but way more of us. And so women themselves are reading the scriptures for themselves in the original languages. And guess what? We're coming up with some different answers.
It's interesting because we were saying before we came on air at the time of recording that there's been some interesting developments, sort of almost a Me Too moment in the evangelical church in the USA as well. Recently, Paige Patterson, former head of the Southern Baptist Convention, came under fire for sermons which have emerged in which he firstly advised women not to divorce abusive husbands but to pray, and where he also appeared to make an objectifying comment that he heard by a young man of another young woman by saying, oh, he's just being biblical. There's been a lot of backlash to that. There's been a letter signed by lots of women who from the evangelical church. It's also come at a time when, interestingly, Beth Moore, who's a well-known Bible teacher in the US, has written an open letter to her male colleagues about some of the experiences she's had as a woman in that environment, where even if people hold the so-called complementarian view, the way they've expressed it has gone way beyond any kind of biblical justification that they could come up with in terms of the way they've treated often women who do hold some kind of a teaching or preaching position. So it feels like there's a lot of energy at the moment around this
definitely.
Issue.
Definitely. Yes, and that's what I notice. And I think it was so interesting that it was the conservative evangelical Baptist women who wrote this letter and signed it. And I hear that by doing that, they're also putting themselves under fire within their own camp. So it to some extent being brave, you know, but that's what I see, is I see a shift. I also see a real shift in the men who are supporting women and doing their own work and their own scholarship and saying that this is actually, dig deeper into the Bible and you will find a different story from the one that where this surface story that seems to have got a hold, where women are subordinate, where men should naturally lead, where a woman should follow. And this effect, you know, we know it affects church leadership, family, marriages, and even the workplace. Right. So it's a serious issue. And the fact that men and women scholars, and now look, women on the ground and men on the ground, are just saying, this isn't good enough. You know, why are we doing it like this? Is good. It's hopeful.
Well, thank you so much for what you've contributed recently to the whole area. And if people want to get hold of the book, it's called Unveiling Paul's Women, Making Sense of 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16. And you can see more about Westminster Theological Centre, where Lucy is the principal, at wtctheology.org.uk. Lucy, time has flown by. I would have loved to spend another hour talking these issues through with you.
Thank you so much. No, thank you.
It's been really fun having
you great.
On the
thank
profile
you.
Today. Do listen back to today's programme at the podcast as well, and tell other people about it too. PremierChristianRadio.com/theprofile or wherever you get your podcast from. And don't forget to ask for a free sample copy of our sister magazine, Premier Christianity Magazine, at PremierChristianity.com/free sample. For now, I've been Justin Brierley with you on The Profile today. Coming up next, the best of Premier in Premier Playback.
Save big money on your roofing project at Menards with Owens Corning Shingles. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements and enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning Duration Shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 24 colors of Owens Corning Duration Shingles and transform your home today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.